Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell, so you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And that is obviously
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships.
You got sex, love, and relationships with Carol the Coach. Hi, I'm Carol Jurgensen Sheets, and I'm so happy to be with you tonight. This is the only show on iTunes that you can subscribe to free and get all 80 episodes. And I feel very honored to be with you, helping you to understand what is this addiction all about. If you're an addict, you might need some additional tools to stay clean. If you're a partner, you might want to know what are the resources available to you as you love somebody who has this illness. Now, of course, there are lots of people that say, Carol, is it really an illness? Is it really a disorder? Well, I'm here to tell you, yes, it is. Absolutely it is. And anybody who's listening to the show probably gets that. They get that because they have compulsive behavior that they cannot stop. And they've tried, and they've tried, and they've tried, and they've not been able to do it. Let's talk about not just compulsive sexual addiction, but believe it or not, compulsive self-deprivation. You know, we typically think of addicts as supremely self-indulgent, and sex addicts especially can appear selfish, self-absorbed, and interested in one thing, meeting their needs. But I'm here to tell you that sex addicts oftentimes may repeat patterns of behavior that actually reflect the sexual trauma and the physical and emotional trauma that they experienced as a child. Now, most of you know that sex addiction is known to be a disease of extremes. You know, sex addicts swing between very out-of-control behavior and controlled behavior. It's an ineffective effort to bring balance in their lives. And I got to tell you, a lot of my clients that are sex addicts also are sexually anorexic. And what that means is that they go for short, medium, or long periods of time without having sex. And the reason that they do that is because they turn off that mechanism so that they don't have to feel the compulsion. But just like with sex addiction, that only lasts for a little while. Now, most oftentimes, sex addicts deprive themselves of healthy self-care. And clearly, when you're looking at the three circles, and, you know, I will bring up a topic like the three circles, and I will get clients and listeners that go, okay, now remind me what the three circles are. Well, if you draw three circles inside of each other, you have the very inner circle, which are the deal-breaking behaviors, prostitution, exhibitionism, voyeurism, affairs, multiple affairs, chronic masturbation, pedophilism, frauderism, those kind of behaviors, and they are deal-breaking because those behaviors chronically get them into trouble with their partners, at their work, and oftentimes with themselves. So those are the behaviors that all addicts try to do without. That next circle are the slippery slope behaviors. You know, the behaviors that so many of my addicts feel like they can look at pornography, and they don't realize that this addiction is extreme. It is progressive. It gets worse and worse. So if you're an addict and you're looking at porn, it's going to take you to a different place. Now, is that an extreme philosophy? Oh, it might be. You know, it some ways parallels alcoholism. When in AA they say, if you're an alcoholic, you don't do any mind-altering drugs. You don't think you have a problem with marijuana? Well, guess what? Don't do it, because it could very well at some point be a gateway to get you started again. Well, that's what these middle circle behaviors are. They get you started again. Then again, the outer circle are the healthy behaviors, and that's what I'm here to tell you today, that the addict does not oftentimes have healthy outer behaviors. Self-deprivation has to do with how you care for yourself, and most oftentimes sex addicts experience a lack of appropriate nurturing. So as an adult, they don't know how to take care of themselves. And when you're a healthy individual, you've got to know how to take care of yourself. I'll give you an example, one of my own personal. My husband and I have a lakefront place, and it pipes broke, and we were taking care of things, and, you know, we had to wait on contractors. We couldn't get in there and do the things we wanted to. And lo and behold, everything got finished except putting up the pool table. I'm quite the pool player, I might add, July 2nd. So my husband says, when we go down on July 4th and 5th, we need to clean everything up. Now, we had been there cleaning up, but he said, I want it to be done. And I said, you know what? It's a holiday weekend. I don't work that way. I'll work for 3, 4, 5 hours, but that's max. I'll get up early. I'll get it done. I'm going to enjoy my day. My husband, on the other hand, my husband has this mind where he clearly wants to start, and he doesn't want to finish until it is finished. And so we had this disagreement about how to take care of things. I wanted to take care of me and be on the boat, soak up the sun, have some friends over after I cleaned. He wanted to clean until it was done and not invite friends. I'm not going to tell you who's right or wrong, but I know for me that was self-care, and that's probably something that you need to examine. Do you take care of yourself? Because that is your responsibility in terms of good self-parenting, to take care of you. So Linda Hatch, somebody I've had on the show before, talks about the seesaw effect. She says, when a sex addict has grown up with inadequate nutrients and a pattern of using sex as a drug, they will cut loose and engage in risky and self-destructive behaviors for a time, and then the addict will completely shut down all self-indulgent behaviors and become the compliant child again, and not attend to their own needs and impulses in healthy ways. Okay? So I ask you, do you take care of your basic needs? Do you find healthy ways of finding pleasure and tolerating pain? Do you live in fear? Do you avoid success and abundance, or do you go after workaholism to find that success? Linda asks very clearly in an article she wrote called Compulsive Self-Deprivation and Addiction Silence. She talks about the fact that these behaviors of compulsive self-deprivation can be very harmful, and they have a long-term effect of keeping you in that intimacy disorder that you already have because of your addiction, keeping you away from healthy partners, and typically you'll neglect all kinds of basic self-care, such as attending to your medical needs, dental needs, your garbage piles up, you don't repair things that break down, you don't pay bills, taxes, you just kind of miss the boat. Do you deny yourself pleasure and tolerate pain? You know, do you restrict your food? Do you go on unusual food regimens and cleansing regimens? Do you cut yourself? Do you avoid sex and other pleasurable activities? Because it feels like a way of righting the wrong of sexual addiction. Well, that's a good question. And so I would ask you to look at your own ability to nurture and ask yourself, are there some self-deprivating qualities to who you are? Self-deprivation provides a platform for sexual acting out. Linda says the addict is, in effect, saying, I have so little to contribute that I deserve to spend as much time as I want on the computer looking at internet pornography. So in other words, that deprivation leads to compulsivity that then is out of control. So think about your life and what you need to make that different. It can be very, very helpful in treating sexual, social, and emotional anorexia. And in asking yourself if you're anorectic, ask yourself, do I go a long period of time without being involved in a sexual or romantic relationship? Do I go a long period of time without having healthy social activities? If I'm in a relationship, have I found that I have difficulty experiencing romance, sexuality, intimacy, and friendship? Am I alone more than I want to be and feel unable to change that? At work, do I have trouble developing relationships and talk only when absolutely necessary or hiding out in work? Do I avoid relationships with certain gender? Do I stay aloof when in groups? Am I afraid of being noticed? And do people exhaust me? Am I enough of an introvert that I actually need to get away from people to regain my sense of energy? Last but not least, do I habitually panic or push people away when they start getting too close? So that is the question. Do you understand that? How that would work? I'm sure it can be very, very tough. I am Carol Jurgensen-Sheets. This is Sex Help with Carol the Coach. And I want you to think about that anorectic behavior and ask yourself, is that an area that you need to change? Welcome, caller. This is Carol Sheets. And who am I speaking with?
This is Jim J.
And you said Jim?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jim, you had been so kind as to offer to talk about your own journey and what you've been through. And, you know, clearly you have in so many ways and experienced the parallels so many other addicts. So I'm glad that you've joined us on the show. Would you share a little bit about your addiction and when you first knew that this was really compulsive?
Well, I've had problems with alcohol and marijuana as well. I think that I've had collections of pornography before the Internet was even in existence. And I realized about 12 years ago that I was hospitalized for a manic attack. And I realized at that time that I was definitely addicted to the pornography. So it's been a while since I've known that.
And do you think that do you think that that addiction contributed to sexual addiction? Because you actually suffered several addictions.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that they're all very much interrelated. I think that the alcohol kind of potentiates my sex addiction by lowering my inhibitions. Well, I would substitute with marijuana use and really wouldn't need anything else if I was smoking marijuana. It's kind of always something. It's been one or the other for a long time, most of my adult life, I would say.
Well, and we were talking about how addicts or that addict mentality can often nurture themselves inappropriately or in unhealthy ways. So do you think that there was something going on with your life that allowed you to rationalize and maybe perhaps minimize the fact that you were choosing marijuana to relax or to lower your inhibitions in any way, shape, or form?
Well, I think that what happened in particular with the marijuana is that had a significant trauma in my life. My wife lost her vision, and I got introduced to spice and then later substituted marijuana for that. Though I had used it a lot when I was back when I was in college, but I had avoided it for almost 20 years until the last few years. But
huge trauma. So you mean you had dabbled with marijuana, you avoided it for a while, and then once she got that diagnosis, you started medicating your feelings. And what feelings do you think you medicated first?
Oh, probably despair, sadness was the primary feeling. And I've kind of combated that most of my life. I've had depression on and off for most of my adult life, and been suicidal many times, only tried it once, but have had inclinations many, many times.
Okay, so you've had a history of some mental illness in terms of depression and suicidality, and so at what point did you begin to dabble in sexually addictive behaviors?
I think that I've kind of always been drawn to the idea of the orgy ever since I got introduced to that and to pornography when I was an adolescent. And was really very awkward around women. And so a lot of my early sexual experiences were with prostitutes. Later, after I got married, after a very limited period of dating, I pushed my wife into swinging and amassed a pornography collection. And I've had pornography collections both in paper form and VHS and DVDs and now on the computer, which is, of course, the biggest and most accessible form. So it's been a long time, but I knew 12 years ago that I was definitely a sex addict. It just because of my
Okay, so 12 years you knew that you were a sex addict, and you knew that the behavior was out of control. What were some of the warning signs that said to you, okay, this isn't just me experimenting, this has control over me?
I think the biggest thing is not being able to stop. My wife would go to bed, and I would get on the computer and say, oh, I'll just look at this material for 20 minutes or so. And then I'd end up still being on the computer at 1 o'clock in the morning, 3 hours later, and lose sleep over it. And I knew that that was out-of-control behavior, that it was just I couldn't stop. And I would find myself at the computer virtually every night doing the same thing.
Okay, and so that number one contributing factor was that you couldn't stop. There was what we call time distortion, which means that 20 minutes turned into 2 or 3 hours. And did your wife know that you were having these difficulties, or were you lying and hiding this from her?
Well, I would try and minimize it. She knew that I looked at pornography, and she didn't like it. But I certainly wouldn't admit to not being able to control it. The other factor was also tolerance, in that I would find myself looking at more and more disturbing images. And I knew that was characteristic of addiction as well, to develop tolerance to things. So you have to kind of get more and more.
Can you give me an example of what you mean by that? How was it affecting your tolerance?
Well, initially, I think, when I was younger, just looking at pictures of naked women was sufficient to be stimulating. But then I found myself going more and more to fetish sites, urophilia, S&M, female domination, and et cetera, to the point where I was looking at, incest stuff, not to the exclusion of child pornography, but looking at adult incest videos and things like that, which I never would have dreamed that I would be looking at, 10 years ago. And so it got very disgusting over the years, and a lot of very shocking things.
Okay, so
and
you
I know
were
a lot of other addicts.
By your own behavior.
Yes, very definitely. A lot of shame and a lot of guilt associated with it, and minimizing it with my wife, so lying about it, and not being able to stop.
Okay.
I know a lot of that have crossed that line and looked at child pornography, and I kind of was right there at the edge, and I thank God that I didn't get into that and get caught and out publicly outed or imprisoned or there, but by the grace of God go I.
Well, absolutely, and yet I, being a certified sexual addictions therapist, know that had you not received intervention, that is what would have happened, that you would have really gotten involved in that. And I don't know that you would have gotten arrested. I don't know if anybody would have caught you, but clearly you would have taken more and more risks.
So, I believe, explain, because...
I happen to know that you have a lot of information about the brain and neurocircuitry and neurotransmitters and neuroplasticity. So tell us a little bit about how addiction like that can affect the brain.
Well, basically, you have a reward pathway in your brain and your limbic system. And it's the mesolimbic pathway, or it's got several names, but basically it's the reward pathway. And what happens is that through repeatedly getting exposed to something, whether it's cocaine or internet pornography, you basically sensitize the neurons and what the neurons that nerve cells that fire together wire together, and that pathway becomes kind of fortified and maybe not physically enlarged, but in terms of how it functions, enlarged. So basically, you go from having a reward pathway to a superhighway, and your brain is sensitized. It hijacks that part of your brain, which is very primitive. It's automatic. It's fast. Things happen in milliseconds, and they happen without your conscious awareness because it's part of your brain that's wired for to seek pleasure, to procreate. It's a survival mechanism that you have this reward pathway. And basically, drugs or sex, addiction, hijacks the brain. And so you have very little choice over it. It's certain physical changes that occur that make you have less and less choice in the matter, in what you do.
Okay, so I got to ask you something. Now, obviously you said that these reward centers then get activated and that it's almost primal that people want to procreate and form bonding. And so in healthy relationships, that may mean that adults pursue each other, they want to get close to each other, they create intimacy, they have sex. But in unhealthy relationships, that means that they look for ways to indulge the brain and create new neural pathways. Is that correct?
Well, to keep you that gets reinforced by the memories, the triggers, and cues get basically hardwired to those images or to those sexual behaviors. And so, I guess I'm not exactly sure how to answer that question.
Okay, that's fair enough.
But it's a hijacking of that pathway, which is a natural pathway. To procreate is normal and it's part of the biological organism. Part of our survival mechanism. It happens subconsciously, and basically drugs and sex hijack that pathway, and it gets reinforced and expanded and extremely sensitized.
Can I ask you what you're doing in the background? There is a lot of paper shuffling going on.
Oh, I'm playing. I had to take the light cover off of my iPhone so I could plug in the jack. And so I'm fiddling with that when talking. But I'll put it down. Okay.
Okay. I was wondering, because I know you're not at work right now, and I'm like, what is he doing? Is he, like, going through his mail, or what's going on? Okay, so
no,
now, it's all right. Hey, tell me, what kind of consequences have you incurred because of your sexual addiction?
Well, basically, I had a successful pediatric career for 27 years in a small town in the Northwest. And when I relapsed, I went to rehab once, and because I was told that I was smoking pot every night, I was in fair condition. Went to rehab, cleaned up my act, but never really got sexually sober for any extended length of time, relapsed sexually, and went back to rehab and was told that I can no longer practice pediatrics. And,
okay, now may I ask you why you think you didn't get sober that or recovered that first time after going to treatment?
Well, several things. One is I did not have a good therapist. I did not have meetings that I could go to more than once a week. I failed too because I didn't maintain contact with my sponsor. I wasn't 100% bought into the program. The other possible excuse is that my medications got changed for management of my bipolar, and I think I was on the wrong medicine as well. But, you know, that's an excuse. I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do to stay sober. It's true.
Okay, so clearly those recovery tools that we talk about on the show, you weren't necessarily utilizing them. And so that's in some way a testimonial to going into treatment, going into a hospital, going into a residential treatment center is not going to work unless you work what they advise. And so you weren't really ready to work yet. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say that's fair. Yeah.
Okay. And so then what happened? After that first treatment center, what did you do next? You had trouble staying sober, and you went to a second one.
Yeah, and this one really knew how to deal with sex addiction. They were like 10 of us there dealing with sex addiction, including a few other physicians as well dealing with it. And but basically they decided because of the pornography I was looking at and a few of the things in my past that I could not practice pediatrics. They wouldn't approve me for that and would not approve me to return to clinical medicine, for that matter, for a year. And
okay,
this was
and is that year up or will that year be up
soon?
No,
won't be up till November. But, of course, what's happened is that basically we moved to Indiana because you're here. Thank you, Carol. And also there's a whole lot of SAA meetings in Indy. And I think addicts here are very fortunate because I don't think there's any other city except maybe Houston that I've been to that has anything like this number of meetings to go to. And we have family here as well, and I'm from Indiana originally. But returning to Indiana, the Physician's Health Program said, we don't want to deal with you. You're a sex addict. We're not going to follow you. And so that pretty much rules out me getting a license in Indiana. And I've had to surrender my license in Washington State. So basically, my addiction cost me my career of 27 years.
Oh, my goodness. So. And certainly, me knowing you, I know how painful that has been. And we are hoping that you're going to figure out another way to contribute because you have such a wonderful medical brain. And there are a lot of roadblocks ahead of you, and you probably never even thought that that would happen to you, that it would result in you losing your job.
No. Oh, no. Not at all. Now, I of course, maybe this was mania talking, but when I chose to act out and to break my marital vows, which I actually hadn't done with my current wife, I was thinking that the Physician's Health Program wouldn't care because they didn't know what to do with sex addiction. And obviously they were extremely concerned and because I really gloriously relapsed. And so.
Okay, now we talk all the time about how addicts have stinking thinking. And obviously by that I mean that you clearly believed and hoped that what you were doing was not going to have an impact in a negative way. And so that was stinking thinking, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was craziness. What I did was I hooked up with guys on Craigslist in a small town where I was pretty well known, had a reputation to protect, and had multiple strange men over to my house. And that's crazy. That's insanity. Those of the addiction, I was acting insane, definitely.
So do you believe that the high was worth the consequences.
Oh, no, definitely not.
Okay. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, I had a decent career. I loved my job. It was stressful, but I really enjoyed it, and I loved it. And the amount of pleasure that I had acting out was, compared to losing a career and ending, finding myself in a position without a job and without maybe being unemployable there's just no comparison whatsoever.
And do you believe, Jim, that your sexually addictive behaviors got worse and worse and worse? Because part of addiction is that it doesn't stand still. It progresses and it gets worse.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just in the type of pornography I was looking at, it got more and more disgusting, more and more socially unacceptable. I was good with my wife for 10 years almost, and finally when I acted out, I had a dozen partners within a period of a week, and that's progression, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, so many addicts have that characteristic of self-loathing. They hate themselves for the damage they've caused themselves or to their partners. Have you gone into any of that low self-esteem, self-loathing, and shame?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, to a huge extent. And I think that was one of the things that the first rehab I was in did not deal with, but the second one very much was aware of is the shame reduction, because it's interesting. The way the brain works is that emotions will actually increase the amount of dopamine and adrenaline that is released in the brain. So basically, if you're looking at something on the computer and it's shocking or disgusting, it actually increases the dopamine and adrenaline release, and so it implants it in your brain even more strongly. And so there's kind of this, you feel shame because you're looking at it, you're disgusted with yourself, but the image sticks in your brain and pushes you to think more and more because you're getting that dopamine. And I know that was the case with me. I would feel shame, especially since I was living two lives. I was loved by my patients, respected by my peers, and at night I'd be looking at depressing pornography and just very much living two lives.
Do you think there that you might have ended up violating the safety of a child?
I don't know. I think it's possible. I certainly had teenage patients, girls that were, very attractive, and medical students I worked with that were attractive, who knows where I would have gone. And if that was the case, if I would, I would have been crucified, basically, because that's not tolerated by society.
Well, understandably, you're laughing, but that's more of a nervous laughter because
definitely. It
would have been very difficult for you. It would have probably been made public, and you would have been shamed publicly. And at least in this respect, by moving out of the area, it's not like you're shamed publicly. You are shamed within your family to some degree. They know what's going on, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't know the details, but my siblings know that I'm a sex addict, and that that's why I can't practice pediatrics. Yeah. But, I wouldn't be able to stand that. I would not be able to stand a public shaming or lawsuits, I would probably commit suicide, I'm sure, without a doubt.
Okay.
That would be too much to handle.
Okay. I could understand that. Now, how has your wife dealt with it? Let's see how good you are at empathy and being able to put yourself in her place. How's she doing?
She's doing okay at the moment, but I know she's experienced a lot of fear because she doesn't want us to break up, fear that she's going to lose me again to rehab, fear that I'm not going to be there for her, and a lot of anger, too, with regards to my acting out. When I have slipped, she's very angry, and understandably so. I mean, you know, especially if I'm not following the program like I'm supposed to.
Hi. So all those things are about the insecurity of loving an addict and wondering how it's going to affect themselves, the relationship, and, of course, you in general. How would you describe your marriage now?
I would describe it as fairly good. I think that we both care about each other very much. We handle conflict fairly well. I think it could be better, but I think things are pretty even keel right now. I need to get my act together. Because
well,
it hurts.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because you are making some dramatic changes in your treatment program. Can you tell our listening audience what you're doing differently that hopefully will ensure more success as a sex addict in recovery?
Well, I've got a new sponsor that I'm staying in touch with more consistently. He is giving me assignments. So I redid my three circles the other day, and I'm making a list of things I'm going to be doing on a daily basis. I'm journaling again, which is good, and praying every day and going to meetings pretty consistently every day. I know I need to do more. I've been kind of busy with getting my parents into assisted living and selling their house, cleaning it out, and it's been kind of hectic the last few weeks.
Oh, I bet. Okay, and so let me ask you, when it comes to how you feel you're doing, you clearly said that you got a ways to go. And what's one more thing that you could tweak in your own recovery that would make a difference?
Well, I can think of two important things off the top of my head. One is calling people.
Okay.
Because we have people in our group that I know fairly well. They know my story. I know their story. They're nice people, nice guys. And they would not mind my calling them, and I have called them on occasion, but I need to do it more consistently. And the other thing is to try meditating again. I'm, you know, been diagnosed as ADD as well, and so just sitting still for 15 minutes is really kind of difficult. But I think I should start making an effort to do that because I'm sure it would be beneficial.
Okay, so
be very
what
helpful.
You know you need to do is to meditate and to get in touch, perhaps center yourself better so that you access more of your internal strengths. Is that correct?
Yeah, that sounds good. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well, because, you know, I'm sitting there thinking to myself, okay, how can meditation help?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's just a means of quieting your mind and opening yourself up more to your higher power. And that's might have a lot of chatter in my brain, and so that would be important to do. And that, making connection with other people and forming new friendships, having more people that I can trust and that I can bounce things off. And I think that's developing with time.
Okay, so you feel like you are developing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And, you know, you said that obviously coming here to Indiana has been helpful because there are a lot of great meetings. You've got a good therapist. Thank you very much. What other healthy behaviors are you following through on? If we look at those 10 recovery tools, and just for our listening audience, we'll go into them real quickly. The 10 recovery tools are having a good therapist, going to individual treatment, going to group treatment, going to 12-step meetings, having a sponsor, making the calls in fellowship, meditating and praying, oftentimes utilizing tools like Covenant Eyes or K9 to actually help you stay accountable. Some people use polygraph tests. And last but not least, it's participating in healthy behaviors, not just sexual healthy behaviors, but healthy individual behaviors. So out of those 10 things, what are you doing and what's one thing that you could increase to ensure more success?
Well, one thing that I think I really need to do is to exercise on a regular basis, because I know I can lose weight if I exercise and watch my diet, and I need to lose about 50 pounds right now. Things I'm doing are maintaining contact with my sponsor, going to meetings consistently, praying every day, journaling on a fairly consistent basis, I'm spending a lot of time with my wife. Of course, I'm not working, so that's inevitable. But we do fun things together, get out of the house together and shop together, and all those things have strengthened our relationship. It has not been hard to spend more time with my wife, which is good.
Okay, so when you're participating in those healthy behaviors, what is that doing to the neural pathways in the brain?
It's forming other pathways that are alternatives to the pleasure and reward pathway that's been fortified by the abuse, it's forming alternates to that pathway where you can experience pleasure in life, and also strengthening the braking system in your brain, which has been kind of gotten weak with time as the neural pathways are overused with addiction.
Okay, so when you create new neural pathways, how does that affect the neuroplasticity of the brain?
Well, what happens is that with repeated exposure to porn or to cocaine or whatever, those pathways get sensitized, and the braking system in your prefrontal cortex gets weakened, and so those are the changes that you see, and it takes 6 to 8 weeks being abstinent from the stimulus or from the drug for those to really heal. Mm-hmm. And so you have to have abstinence first, and then the neuroplasticity of the brain kind of guarantees that things will get better if you can maintain abstinence.
Okay, that totally makes sense. It really does prove that sexual addiction is a condition of the brain. It's not just a moral issue, but it really has to do with neurochemistry of the brain.
Yeah, there was one study that questioned that and got a lot of play in the popular press, but I think it was kind of a little bit flawed. And there have been other studies in mice and looking at the brains of people that have sexual compulsive problems that would definitely support that assumption that it's a disease of the brain. So American Psychiatric Association didn't add it to the list. They did not consider it a disease of the brain, unfortunately. So, but
so are you disappointed by that, especially being in the medical community?
Oh, very much so, because I think it's just so obvious that it's the same neural pathways, and you know, people respond to internet pornography just like they do to crack cocaine, and it's a bigger and bigger problem because you have younger and younger teenagers and whatnot being exposed to it. And I think it's going to be a big problem in our society unless something changes, something happens to either cut it off as a source or to treat it. It's rampant, I think. I mean, not everybody that looks at pornography is going to get addicted to it, but it's just so prevalent that you're going to have more and more addicts out there.
Right. Absolutely. Well, as we kind of wrap up, and obviously you've been open and honest and candid about your illness, can you, is there anything you want to add for our listening audience? Because it really, it's comprised of two different categories, the addict, him or herself, and the partner. So what else might you add in terms of hope, strength, and recovery, which is the subtitle of this show?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that for the partners, my feeling is that it's very important for the partners of addicts to pursue their own program and to maybe not try and micromanage the addict, because that just builds resentment, creates frustration, and you got to work on yourself and get some help for yourself. My wife is doing that, and I think it makes a huge difference. And as far as the addicts go, you know, I think it's a message of hope, because there's a lot out there now, and there's good therapy, and there's a lot of meetings and a lot of people out there that are willing to help out, and just have to make an effort to show up, to make the phone call, that's all it takes. So there is definitely hope.
Well, it's good to hear that. And when you think about your other addiction, marijuana smoking, how are you doing with that?
Yeah, I haven't smoked marijuana for over 2 years, and I had a few drinks a year ago on one night. Otherwise, I haven't drank for 2 years either. So those are actually a lot easier to deal with than the sex addiction.
Now, why do you think that is?
Oh, because it's so easy to slip up with the sex addiction. I can get around Covenant Eyes and pretty easily and find stuff to look at. And, you know, it's just so easy and it's secret. Unless I choose to be totally honest, it's secret, and it's just so easy to slip up, and but I don't want to go back there. Yeah, it is not good.
Well, I appreciate your time. You've been through a lot, and you know you're prone to bipolar depression as well as these addictions. So it really is an experience where you have to just take one day at a time, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You keep working with that. You keep working with that sponsor, because I think it's so important for you to have a mentor, and for anybody out there, it is really helpful to not do this on your own. If you think you can do it on your own, you will fail. You need somebody wiser, smarter, who's been through it and can almost foresee what's going to happen so that they can take you down a different path. And you're actually now working the steps, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you were doing that in a step workshop. Yeah. So what step are you on right now?
Doing step four, pretty much finished it up. I'm going to do step five with my sponsor in a couple of weeks.
Okay. Well, I wish you the best of success. I will see you soon, as you well know. And thanks again for sharing your hope, strength, and recovery. It is always important when you're dealing with addiction not to have secrets. And so you've been really brave and courageous to just share your story out there to everybody. Thank you so much, Jim.
No problem. Happy to do so.
Okay.
Have a good evening.
Hey, you too. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You too can share your story. If you believe that it's something that might help somebody, I would highly recommend that you email me at carolthecoach@aol.com. And let me know that you've got a story. Give me just a little background via an email, and we'll set that up too. You know, if you've been listening to this show, I interview experts in the field, whether they've written books, whether they run groups, whether they're part of a treatment center. But I do believe people get a lot out of hearing the issues that addicts face when they're courageous enough to talk about them. So I appreciate you listening to the show. As you well know, next week I'm going to be on vacation, but guess what? I am going to still be available to you. We're going to be interviewing Bill and Ginger Burkhall. They have written a second book on sexual reintegration. They talk about, you know, what do you do to get back on track with your partner when you've had addiction in your life and you want to rebuild the trust and the intimacy that's so badly needed. I recommend this book to lots and lots of clients. So I look forward to meeting and talking with them, sharing with you. And I can't emphasize enough, if you need something, call me. You can reach me at 317-847-2244. You can always call the show, and that number is 646-595-3284. And last but not least, I do accept emails. And I'm going to have a new website that actually is coming out this week. I don't think it's live yet, but it's called Sex Help with Carol the Coach. And get on that website and see what I have to offer, the different podcasts, the different products, and what I call hope, strength, and recovery stories from my clients who share with you what they've been dealing with themselves. You have a great night, have a wonderful week, and I'll see you next Monday for more Sex Help with Carol the Coach. As I end the show every week, there'll only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. Have a great one. Talk to you soon.